This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 135th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is visual thinking is philosophical thinking. I'm joined by Mark Staff Brandel. He is the author of A Philosophy of Visual Metaphor in Contemporary Art. The publisher is Bloomsbury Academic. Mark is an artist and art historian with a PhD from the University of Zurich. He is an associate professor of art history emeritus at the Art Academy of Liechtenstein and Higher Professional College for Art in St. Gallen, Switzerland. His work has been shown in numerous galleries and museums from Europe, America, Egypt, and elsewhere. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hi, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Absolutely. So let's get people oriented. In a nutshell, what's this book about?
Okay, it's about visual metaphor, but this can become very, because it's in a philosophy series, it can have too much jargon, but I'll do my best. What I would say is that my point is, and the book is, metaphors are the foundation of visual thought, are chiefly determined by bodily and environmental experiences, and then are then resourcefully embodied in artistic form. In short, visual artistic creation is philosophical thought, as you just said, accomplished through original metaphor embodiment. So what it all leads up to, this whole thing, is you go from experience in life and so on, you get insights. These are then in metaphors in your brain, which includes emotions and also thought. That goes to experience in the form process and materials and so on of the artwork, thus is re-embodied creatively, not illustrated, but that's my whole point. Thinking.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm a poet, so as you can imagine, I'm interested in metaphors. Once back in the day, I have a master's in creative writing from Brown University on the East Coast. So
poetry is the closest to visual. It's really close, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to open with, before we get into some of the nuts and bolts, you have some large statements that you make in the course of the book. And I wanted to tap into two or three of these and give you a chance to kind of unpack them or elaborate on them so that listeners have an idea where you're coming from. So one of them that caught my attention was, you say at one point, the academics were trapped in an illusionary past. Formalist modernists felt delusionally free from the past, and the deconstructivist postmodernists sometimes appear endlessly tangled in an inescapable present. That's a quite interesting comment, and it goes lots of directions. So can you elaborate on that? Explain it a bit for us.
Well, the main one of the main things is that my book is actually kind of controversial. Somebody told me I was lucky. I already was well enough known as an artist and had my professor jobs, although I'm retired, thank God, because I would have trouble getting it, because right now most things are postmodern. Their hegemony is text-based. They believe the basis of all thought is language. And so they are stuck in the present, I would say. They try and ignore the past and so on. The academicists, that was just one group of artists before modernism, they were just stuck on the past. They only want to do historical painting and religious painting. You know, they couldn't seem to do the present. That was modernism, was revolt against that, to do the present. But modernists, towards the end, got stuck in that too. So people will get one direction or the other. And of course, my point is that you got to have the past. I'm an art historian, but it's something to use as media to then deal with, think about the future and deal with the present to see if we can make the future better.
Yeah, well, you mentioned in giving your answer that it's a controversial book. And yes, it certainly struck me as I read it that you weren't afraid to make bold statements, which I welcome. It's more interesting. So let me go to another one of those in regards to the Western art canon or art history canon. You said that in some hands, at least, what we have now is a shrunken paucity of visual aids to solipsistic fear. That is an equally strong comment. I'm going to give you a chance to explain what you're about with that remark.
That's my attack on the post-structuralists again. They will do things like say, oh, you can't really teach the past. Well, this could be a long answer, but I'll try and keep it short. That, so we should just ignore the whole thing. No, the thing is right now, art history, and I say this a lot when I do my Dr. Great Art presentations, it's not wrong, but it's far from the entire truth. Far, far. And so people will say, oh, there's this like, well, then let's not teach anything. No, you need to know it now and more. So you learn the standard art history, and then that's only European and American. And where are the women? And where are the Black people? And where is Africa? And where is, et cetera. And so essentially that's my attack on that, is you need to do all that and not get stuck with, say, okay, well, then I won't teach history at all. I'll just look at, illustrate my philosophical theory. Art historians and philosophers, of which I am also one, but I'm also an artist, can be dangerous because they start to want art to say, to illustrate their ideas. And no, art is itself, and then our ideas should help us try and understand art. Yeah.
Sure. Well, I have a PhD, and I did a very contemporary topic, and it was hard to put together a committee because, as I joked to my friends, scholars prefer dead artists rather than living artists because the living artists can potentially contradict them, and they don't welcome that. Let's go on to one other statement you made here, which I thought was interesting and gets into some different camps that are involved. You say that connoisseurs are regrettably almost gone, critics sliding into irrelevancy, art historians under pressure from theorists, curators, and creative philosophers. And then you mentioned that one very powerful group, collectors, often don't get acknowledged as part of the discourse, but they're obviously a big player. So you got all those groups vying to kind of help define the landscape. I want to give you a chance to say a bit more about that particular part.
Well, that'd be so hard. That's only sort of a side issue to my book, which is actually about how artists think visually. But I can't not be polemical because I exist in the art world and I exist pretty well, but I'm also pretty cranky. And the essentially, a lot of things have shifted. The curators took over the art world in about 1985. The gallerists have been sort of pushed into of no importance. Critics have totally faded away, partially. It's their own darn fault. So just the whole thing. And collectors are actually, I was written actually too nice to them. The real collectors have tended to fade away too and been replaced by speculators. So the art world is very unhealthy. It's in a transitional period, though. It's very similar to mannerism or academicism, I would say. We're in a transition before postmodernism. We need a new something after that. It's like between the Renaissance and the Baroque. The next thing will not be a return to modernism, but will be something new. But of course, there's bigger things to solve than art. We have to solve things like, you know, economic situations and so first, but art's part of it. Yeah.
Okay. No, that's fair enough. And I think redefining the collectors as speculators in lots of cases is true to the mark of what's going on. So one of the reasons when you reached out to me with the book, I was intrigued because, as I mentioned, I'm a poet, but it's also because Metaphors We Live By is on my bookshelf by Lakoff and Johnson, one of my all-time favorites. So as we dive into your book, do you want to talk about that book maybe a little bit? And you also had mentioned Noel Carroll and a groundbreaking essay on visual metaphor. So I want to kind of now move in closer to metaphor itself and get to some of the antecedents that were probably influential for you. And you're not just honoring them. You're also obviously coming with your own angle on these things.
Okay. I'm very much based in Lakoffian cognitive metaphor theory, which is actually Johnson and Turner, even better in some ways in the my direction. But anyway, since you know it, I have to explain it to a lot of people because it sits somewhere between analytic philosophy and post-structuralism. And actually, I see it as an expansion. Lakoff sees himself as a bit of a reaction against analytic philosophy, but I think he actually expanded it. I think it's more of a reaction against post-structuralism. What can we say about that? I'm mixing all three, actually, in many ways. The main thing is that what Lakoff and all his followers, including me and stuff, is they have real scientific studies to prove these things. It's not just armchair philosophizing. And they have things usually very appreciated by poets, which makes me trust it more. That book is one that started my whole thought and helped me get out of certain problems I had. But anyway, they're saying that metaphors are embodied, that mental concepts are constructed tropaically from bodily experiences, that these are then, I'm saying these are the tool and a goal. Who else I say? Noel Carroll. I'll go more into cognitive metaphor afterwards, I suppose. But Carroll is the only one who's done anything about visual metaphor. I like his theories about lots of things. I've read all his books. He has one essay. It's the only one, really, called Visual Metaphor. So my book is actually the first full book. There are books that are kind of handbooks for advertising and so on, but not dealing with creativity and not really going deep into the Lakoffian or cognitive metaphor aspect. So there's the combination. But yeah, Noel Carroll, I even have in one of my drawings that's a frontispiece there, is kind of the patron saint of one chapter. What can we say about Lakoff? He says we experience things bodily and that is then the basis, he and his people, for our thought processes. And out of that, out of basic metaphor or trope, actually, if I would use the correct word, it goes then in different directions, only one of which is language. And I would hope that my book opens up a whole new field where people would also then go on and talk about how this applies to dance and music and other stuff, because I think it would work, but I don't know enough about that. I had to limit it. Can't dance at all.
The Carroll book does, in fact, if I understand correctly, hit on painting, sculpture, photography, theater, video. I mean, it goes lots of directions, but it's an essay as opposed to a book.
Yeah, it's one chapter, but it's amazingly great. I'm taking a little bit of an exception with it, only to the extent where I'm expanding it in a way, is he tends to deal, like most philosophers, with things primarily based on the subject matter. So he's always talking about things that are basically surrealist or something. Yeah, well, they're easier to describe. And then you say, here's a metaphor between this and that. And I think it's in the form. So I talked a lot about abstract art in my book, although I am not an abstract artist, because I believe it works that way too. Thus the implications for music and so on. That, for instance, one of my key insights that led me to write this was, I realized that this is not abstract, but it's semi-abstract, is that Vincent van Gogh turned the paint stroke into a little flame, and that
which I absolutely loved. One of my favorite parts of the book. Yeah,
it's the one of the clearest, because I think he's one of the clearest painters. He's a great thinker. It's not just a feeler, but he also feelers. He invented painting your feelings. But since it's a flame, he accesses all those foundational metaphors of flame, heat and passion and all those things. So it's in the form, and then it became pervasive. He extended it to flame like forms of composition and flame-like forms of the buildings and so on. And I do this to some fully abstract artists like Dan Ramirez.
And the cypress trees literally seem like a flame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're one of the best ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you see the whole, how that then becomes pervasive in a great artist like Van Gogh or James Joyce or whatever. And other ones can be great too, but they're so pervasive. It's amazing. So I do extend Carol in and make a big deal out of that. I see it in the formal aspects, which for me, and that's why I have that pun word in there, because I'm bad at that, is metaphor. And then with an M at the end, because it doesn't work in German, but it works because metaphor in German is metaphor, but it works well because it's meta formal. But also a metaphor. And so in a certain way, I'm turning formalism on its head. I'm actually attacking it. I'm saying, though, that form is the most important thing often, but it's because it embodies content.
Okay. Speaking of content, because we've got the medium and we've got the content, and they're both rich for exploration here. But I'll stay with the form for a moment. So you mentioned that visual metaphors are not identical to literary metaphors. And then if we switch over to content in the same question that I'm posing to you just to confuse you, when we're talking about visual metaphors in art versus advertising, because you mentioned Barbara Phelps had written a book about visual metaphor in advertising. So I'm interested in visuals, both in art versus advertising, and I'm interested in the contrast of visual metaphors as opposed to literary metaphors. So kind of a two-part question.
Well, it's just different. I wouldn't say it's like better, but I did have people say, oh, well, then visual metaphors are just sort of like illustrations, pictures of that you could say better in a sentence. But you as a poet will know that that's nonsense. Poetry is also so complex. It's not just sentences. You can't rephrase it. About design first, I have a whole podcast I did about that. Design is just simpler. It has no multivalency. It's not polysemic. And art and poetry and literature and so are all polysemic. That's what makes them so good. They have many layers of meaning. And so that's much more complex. Design is much simpler. And sometimes it's stronger for that. It's one iconic shout. But it's not complex, you know. And so that's where I make the difference with that. And there's so many books about that. What was the other part was about comparison to...
Between art and advertising.
And yeah, so I did cover that. That's the difference. It's just I want to say, well, I'm looking here at creative use of metaphors, not just, oh, this could be that. Yeah, up is more positive and so on. But that's like a handbook, you know. My point is always that they're intertwined. The form and the content are actually in each other because it's embodied. You can't
I like that a lot. Yeah. Form and content are in each other.
Yeah. And so I think I said somewhere that they are they're intertwined, and I can't remember exactly. I had a better way of saying it there. And as a matter of fact, in the process too, because you often discover, that's how you discover it, you know, like throwing spaghetti against the wall to see if it sticks, and it doesn't stick, then you do it again. And so you discover your metaphors. You don't just apply them. You discover them in your processes and so on, and then you change them. And so it keeps going. And I wrote in there once because somebody asked me about this sort of criticism. I said, well, that sounds like a blind man like tapping his way along while also inventing the stick. And I said, that's what I think it is. Yes.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Well, I mean, the poet Robert Frost said, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. I mean, it is a discovery. I never wrote anything good that didn't surprise me. Otherwise, it's essentially stillborn. So before we run out of time here, I want to get to a couple other things. One is back to Van Gogh and that he kind of, you know, this flame element in his art. Are there other kind of metaphorical summaries like that, you know, Van Gogh and the flame, different that you could apply for other artists, you know, whether it's Magritte or Picasso?
Well, Rembrandt, I think choose. All the great ones, and that's what I tried to do. And I did one whole chapter on a couple of living artists. Well, one just died, but they're younger than me. But those really quick, Van Gogh, so you can say Van Gogh, Americans say Van Gogh, and the British say Van Gogh, and the French say Van Gogh, and we art historians have decided, because it actually would be Van Gogh, and we can't do it, so we try and somewhere in between. But his is so clear, that's why. Yeah, and at the same time, you have Cezanne with building block-like strokes. And
yeah, I like that one.
Structure, yep. And yeah, he's building. You've got lots of people like that. I think pretty much everybody that you have, and some can be, and in the postmodern time, the extremely complex ones like Charles Birchi that I talk about. He does like geometric things, and then you expect, okay, it's going to be like Max Bill or whatever, and it's going to be primary colors, and he uses extremely unprimary colors. So it's a unification of the something that was hated in modernism, which is referential color, but in this totally non-referential structure. So he, you know, the postmodernists can tend to use more mixed up and therefore more complex versions. But yeah, I think there's lots of them. Who else could I say that's off the top of my head that's a clearer one? Well, Cezanne is pretty clear. A lot of people where the stroke is the basic thing, and that's modernism, is clearer. And postmodernism is a bit more complex because it can even be the presentational form or, you know, and the found object and all those things. But I think it's still all there. His was the one that just was my insight.
Yeah. It works really, well there. I was curious, this might be an off the mark sort of question, but I'll throw it out there anyway and take the chance. Have you tracked these kind of core metaphors, speaking of Van Gogh still and et cetera? I'm curious if you've seen them vary by era or by country or by movement. I mean, at one point you're talking about life as a journey, and we're kind of into talking about medieval, early Renaissance art and, journey to the promised land, literally, figuratively. But I was curious, as you looked over eras and movements, because I know you like to create charts and you've been very interested in the passage of art history over the centuries, if you had any answer to that question, or we should just abandon it.
Yeah, I think a lot. I mean, I taught the survey mostly. And I still do a Dr. Gradar presentation where I do the entire history of art, 60,000 years in an hour and a half. And it's, of course, kind of amusing. And I do also the one only women. Now I lost track because I started to do my advertising. But about the time. Yeah, I think my theory, it's sort of this agonistic thing, a little bit Harold Bloom, where artists do it on a more personal level. I think since the Renaissance, it holds. Now, I only cover contemporary art, and that's mostly postmodern, but I also do a little modern because Van Gogh and so on. But the and some late modernists, like Bill Conger. But the I think it goes all the way back to the Renaissance. Now, before that, I think it was more cultural. So you probably had groups of people doing it. But yes, I suspect it goes way back, but exactly how individual or how group is it changes. And I think primarily it has to do with people trying to find metaphors to express what they think is important. And that is a cultural aspect. So that's one of the things we would have to do now to get out of postmodernism and modernism is look more at things like democracy in art and so on. What would that be metaphorically and so on? And so, I think that it does happen at all the times and stuff. It's just depending sort of how expanded it is or how similar. In modernism, of course, almost everything was individualistic, and we still cling to that. But
sure. One last question here before we wrap up. You cite Cornel West, who I like very much, and you, I guess, prophetic pragmatism is the handle or label for it, but it had four elements, and I'm particularly interested in the last two. The first two were discernment and connection. Last two were tracking hypocrisy and hope. Now, hope is obviously emotional. Tracking hypocrisy makes me think of the emotion contempt, that you don't trust or respect something, that there is indeed hypocrisy involved. And kind of related to those two things, hypocrisy and hope, you say there's an overemphasis on irony that is dominating contemporary visual art. So I wanted to make sure this last question brought us into contemporary art, because that's, after all, the focus of your book. And wherever you want to take that question or that lead in.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, because I'm really, actually, in a certain sense, I'm proselytizing for, hey, let's get out of it. You can't just stop. People are, okay, it's not, okay, then we'll stop. No, you have to work your way through things. And so we're learning something, and there's going to be a post-postmodernism. We artists call postmodernism POMO. So I always laugh because I think, well, postmodernism, POMO, it sounds like a bad dance or something. But the... yeah, Cornell is very inspirational to me on keeps me hopeful, actually. He calls it prophetic pragmatism. I would probably call it philosophical pragmatism. We are both philosophical pragmatists based on William James and Dewey and so on. His point about that, yeah, I think you have to criticize and then you have to work towards what could be good. I mean, the most important emotion, I think, is hope. And I think all really good points of culture have been based on hope. People will say, well, you needed like a crisis. And it's like, no, it was after the crisis when there were partial solutions almost always. And people start to go, well, you know, but it could get better in this way. And that's when you have flowering. I mean, I saw that to a small extent. I'm old enough that I was involved with the anti-war movement and so on. And it was a bad time, you know, fighting police in the streets and so on. But there was feminism started, the civil rights moves that we were like, wow, but it's probably going to get better, although it's terrible. It didn't, actually. It got worse. But the hope, I saw that as like a miniature version probably of the Renaissance, where they were like, hey, we could solve things, humanism and so on. You know, so I think hope is the most important thing. It is hard, though. I mean, I don't know how but you feel, but I ask my students when I talk about that always, how many of you really feel hope about the future? And almost nobody does. They feel that they can work to get through it and so on, and we can still do good stuff, but they don't have really hope. And I have to say, neither do I, but it's not just because I'm an old fart. It's also they don't, and it's our times. But I think we have to work through that. And that's Cornell's thing, is how do we engender hope? How do we convince people not to kill themselves, is one of his phrases.
Yeah, I think particularly in the Black community, historically, given the adversity, you know, as Jesse Jackson always said, keep hope alive, because it's that fundamental lifeline emotionally to try to stay creative and try to stay positive. And otherwise, what do you do? Surrender to fear? That's anger. Yeah.
Those are not surrender, even, which I think a lot of people would like us to do, surrender to ennui or just that kind of things. No, do stuff and we'll do our best. And you'll say, well, it could be like, you know, you'll go down in flames. Somebody said that to me once in my presidency. I go, yes, I probably will.
But your point was, you said irony is dominating, dominating sounds, yeah, not productive. So I assume you're seeing irony as a bit of a I don't know if I want to go this far, a cheap out to hope instead. I don't know how
definitely
you want.
I do. As a matter of fact, I love irony and I use it a lot, but it has dominated postmodernism. It is really I'm thinking in German all of a sudden, Feigling, it's cowardice. And Yeah, if you can't do anything else, then you can attack something, you know, and haha, we're so cool. You know, there's so much of that, like a Catalan taping a banana to the wall. It's what a friend of mine calls tee-hee-hee art, because curators like, ha-ha-ha, we get it, nobody else does. You know, so this irony has, we've got stuck in it. A little bit of irony is important, but it should be self-irony. You should make fun of yourself. And the, because then you really reach the point. And until we break that, the back of that unproductive application of that now unproductive metaphor, there's a million other metaphors to use. There's, and I'm particularly interested in metalepsis, which is playing metaphors off other metaphors. So you're trying to critique past metaphors. So Lakoff says, like, well, why are all the metaphors for marriage based on war? Why can't we make a culture like based on a mutual work of art, which is just as difficult, but you're not trying to kill your husband or wife, you know? So we have to work on other metaphors. And I think primarily to engender hope. And I find that the most difficult, but I think it's what we need to do.
Okay, well, I think that's an excellent place to lead the conversations. I think that's, you know, a near and dear message that you wanted to deliver, and I'm glad we could do that here. So just kind of wrap things up for everybody. My guest today has been Mark Staff Randall. He is the author of A Philosophy of Visual Metaphor in Contemporary Art. This has been episode 135. If you've enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. As listeners know, I like to conclude with an episode, every episode with an epigram that I find appropriate. In this case, I took one from Paul DeMond, who said, "Metaphors are much more tenacious than facts." I love that. Until next time, take care and
Thank
be
you.
Well.
Thank you,
Mark. Okay.